It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Plenty to cover, as there always is, and you're a minute short this week. I took it away from you. That's penalty.
Oh, that's okay. The reggae people won't mind.
No, they won't. They insist.
Time's slower in the universe.
expands. Certain things.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So I saw there was an article in yesterday's paper. It's interesting, relating to Aaron Dixon's campaign. It's interesting how much more coverage he gets than, let's say, Mark Wilson's campaign. But
well, I mean, part of that is that Dixon just declared a couple of weeks ago, and there was a flurry of coverage around that, whereas Mark Wilson has been running for over a year. And when he declared, nobody was really focusing on the Cantwell campaign. But you're right. Mark Wilson's campaign needs more coverage. And I mean, I certainly plan to write about him, you know, in the future as we get closer to the primary. But Dixon is in the news again. David Goldstein at horsesass.org broke the story on Thursday, which is what appeared in Friday's PI, about Dixon having not voted since 1998 and having an inactive voter's registration with an incorrect address in it. But yesterday, he and his readers came up with quite a bit more, and it's quite a bit more damaging, and I can't imagine that the daily papers won't be on this, too. And it's not even so much Dixon. It makes the Greens look really, really bad. What Goldstein and his readers came up with includes the following, that not only has he not voted since 1998, but he had never voted before 1998. In nearly 40 years as an adult, mostly living in this area, he's never voted in King County. He has had 18 criminal cases in the last 17 years, most of them, but not all of them, for traffic violations. He has literally dozens and dozens of unpaid King County District Court and Seattle Municipal Court traffic violations and fines, including a number for driving without insurance, which he, you know, can certainly afford. As the media manager for his campaign, a person who he identifies on his website as his wife, is in fact not his wife, or at least we better hope that she isn't, because he's still in the process of divorcing his last wife, and he owes thousands of dollars in child support to a previous wife. Aaron's a good guy, and he has a long track record as a community activist in this city, although I think when you get into people like my editors at Seattle Weekly and a lot of other people, white folk, all they can fixate on is Aaron's past in the Black Panther Party when he's a teenager. The interview / column I put in the Weekly with him this week, you know, they accompanied with an inflammatory photo of him as a Black Panther in 1968, which I didn't mention in my column at all. But that's what they're thinking of him at. There are a lot of other people who have a grudge against the Greens because they think the Green Party run of Ralph Nader gave the presidency to George Bush in 2000. So for those reasons in particular, but it's also just campaign 101, that you vet your candidate. You do research on him, because if you're going to be taken seriously, you know that the opposition will do research on him. And these are all public records that can be found very easily by anybody who knows what they're doing. So the question is, you know, the Greens recruited Aaron to run for the U.S. Senate. He has never himself aspired to enter electoral politics. When you enter electoral politics, when you throw your hat in the ring, your private life becomes an open book. It's really unfortunate, because it shouldn't have that much to do with whether you're qualified to hold public office, but it does. It's an image thing. It's a character thing, and a lot of people pay attention to it. And you know, by those standards, Aaron Dixon probably shouldn't be running for U.S. Senate, and the Greens should have identified that before they ever approached him. And they could have approached another activist in the community, another African American, whatever their criteria were, and asked that person instead. You know, Dixon should have told the Greens about his personal problems. You know, he's certainly not the first community activist to have a messy personal life. I don't really blame him for any of this stuff, although particularly the back child support is a little disturbing. But, you know, it happens in people's lives. But it makes a huge difference when you're running a political campaign. And, you know, the Greens having not done this is making them essentially a laughingstock among political circles in this area. They're, you know, they've really done severe damage to the credibility of their party, because what they've done is demonstrate that they're not aware, or at least in this case, they weren't aware of one of the absolute basics of running a credible campaign. And in the process, what they've done is ensure the public humiliation of a very good guy who has a long track record of doing good things in the community. And they've hurt themselves very badly as well. It's really, really unfortunate. But all of this was completely preventable by anybody who really knew what they were doing with a campaign. And it's just really sad to see.
All right. Anything else on that, or moving along?
Let's move along.
All right. Moving on to city politics. The city of Seattle and King County both had some proposals this week to combat global warming.
Yeah, Ron Sims came out on Wednesday with his plan for King County to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. He said it had nothing to do with Al Gore and Greg Nickels' appearance on Friday and a release of similar things for the city of Seattle, that the timing was entirely, quote, accidental. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But he did it on Wednesday. Nickels did it on Friday with Al Gore there, and Al Gore is touring the country talking about global warming. He, in fact, has a film coming out in May that hopefully will bring a lot of attention to the global warming issue. It's something Gore has been spending a lot of time on recently. You know, I'm sure he still has political aspirations, but it's also something he clearly believes in. But this raises a couple of really pressing questions. I'm really glad that Sims and Nickels are taking this seriously, that they've been, in Nickels' case and are now in Sims' case as well, among the forefront of elected executives in local areas around the United States who are trying to do what the Bush administration, in probably the most criminal act of a dreadfully criminal administration, has failed to do. They've failed to do anything for five critical years about global warming. But Al Gore wrote Earth in the Balance in 1992. Even then, scientists had been sounding the alarm about global warming for several years. It's been 14 years since Gore wrote Earth in the Balance. Eight of them, of course, were the Clinton-Gore administration, which not only did nothing on global warming, but also was an active impediment to the Kyoto Agreement. And then we've had Bush, who jettisoned Kyoto entirely. Where has Sims been? Where has Nickels been? And while meeting the Kyoto, or trying to meet the Kyoto levels is a laudable goal, it's going to take much, much, much more than that to have any kind of discernible impact on global warming at this point. Because over those 14 years, what has happened is that the rate of increase of global warming has exceeded the predictions of virtually every scientist. It's gotten a lot worse. In fact, some scientists now believe that we're approaching or even at the point of no return, where the changes in the atmosphere will start feeding on themselves, and it doesn't matter what humanity does. Well, you know, you still have to make the effort, and making the effort involves things like eliminating our use of fossil fuels, redesigning our cities, their transportation systems, the industries, private industry, how we operate in our homes. All of these sorts of things need to be radically rethought if we're going to be able to have any kind of an impact on global warming. And that's particularly true in the United States, which has a disproportionate share of the world's emissions of greenhouse gases, just because we're such a materialistic consumptive society. So, you know, it's one thing to meet the Kyoto Protocol levels, and that's fine and good and wonderful, and I very much applaud it. But we're going to need to be able to do a lot more than that. You know, it raises questions like, why are taxpayers spending so much money to develop an industrial park for biotech, which is not even proven to be a profitable industry yet, when you know there's going to be a huge demand in coming years to develop new technologies that can develop energy sources that are renewable and that can replace fossil fuels. Why not subsidize those industries and bring them to our local area and develop an industrial park around that? It's probably not only a better business idea, but it would also be very good public policy and very good for the planet. There's just a bunch of things that can still be done. So, Sims, Nichols, very good work, but we need to do a lot more. And I think what we're getting to, particularly in the blue states and the coastal states, is a critical mass of public understanding that we're going to need to do an awful lot on global warming in the coming years. And I think the people are ahead of the politicians on this one, and we've just got to push and push and push for folks to think creatively and start adopting renewable energy sources and some of the other things I mentioned.
Okay. Well, to be fair, then, why would we push forward like a concept like an expensive tunnel that's just going to be supporting cars that we don't need?
Well, I mean, the question isn't the use of cars, because I think in individual private vehicles, we're so wed to that sociologically that it's probably much more likely that we're going to find different ways to power those vehicles rather than giving up the vehicles entirely. But it does bring up the question of why we've got an alphabet soup of public transit agencies who can come together with a coordinated plan and get more funding for public transit in King County. We need to change our urban geography in such a way that people don't have to use private vehicles if they don't want to. And a lot of areas, especially once you get outside the city of Seattle, you have to have a car in order to be able to commute to your job or, get to the grocery store or whatever, because the public transit system just isn't good enough.
All right, moving along, the Seattle City Council opted this week for increasing the heights of downtown buildings.
Yeah, and this has been coming. Peter Steinbrück has led the effort on City Council to try and mitigate the aggressive growth in office buildings and the downtown skyline that the Nichols administration has wanted. What Steinbrück wanted was a $20 per square foot of new higher cap office buildings to be assessed that would go into a fund to provide affordable downtown housing. The goal of the city for some time has been to try and develop more housing downtown. There's only something like 18,000 people that live downtown in Seattle compared to, say, 67,000 in Vancouver, B.C. And the city would very much like more residential density downtown in the manner that we've seen it in Belltown, for example. So Peter wanted a $20 per square foot assessment on that. Nichols wanted only $10 per square foot, which tells you where his priorities are. The council compromised much more in Steinbrück's direction. The final agreement, depending on some of the details that haven't been ironed out, will be somewhere between $17 and $19 per square foot. But it also raises the question of where are you going to build affordable housing downtown, because the land costs are so expensive down there unless you have absolute requirements that developers build this housing and make it affordable and specify. You'd also almost have to do it through rent control, which is illegal in the state of Washington right now. In order to have rents that are truly affordable as opposed to just below the market rate of the high-end housing that's likely to be developed downtown. If you're charging rents in, say, a rent-to-buy condo of $2,000 a month, affordable housing is not making a few units $1,500 a month. You need something that will enable poor and working class people to not have to flee for the suburbs, thereby exacerbating urban sprawl, thereby contributing to global warming, for example. And so far, we really haven't gotten those policies in the city of Seattle. So this is it's a good step, but it needs policy follow through.
Finally, coming up on Monday, there's a vote for increasing the taxes for the trolley.
Yes, this is for South Lake Union, and it's yet another example of city money going to underwrite Paul Allen and Vulcan Ventures endeavors. It's Monday at 2:00. The full city council is going to vote on how they're going to fund the $3 to $6 million in cost overruns for the streetcar, whether it's going to be through general city general fund city money, that is taxpayer money, or whether it's going to come through assessments given to property owners in the area that the streetcar serves. Apparently, the council is split on this 4-4. The swing vote is Sally Clark, the new member who was appointed to the council about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And word is that Clark is going to propose a quote compromise, but the compromise actually is basically the using a different fund, but a fund that is still provided by taxpayers in order to underwrite the cost of the streetcar. So you know, if people can get down to city council to voice their support for making Vulcan and making other property owners in the neighborhood actually pay for the cost of that this essentially vanity project, please get down there, make yourselves heard.
Or, of course, there's always the phone and email.
Yes, that's very true as well.
On a state level, the ACLU is doing some more FOIAing here.
Yes. ACLU in Washington State has filed Freedom of Information Act requests on behalf of 11 Washington State peace groups, trying to determine the extent to which FBI and other agencies have been monitoring peace groups in the state. This is something that we already know is happening. We talked about this, I think, a couple of weeks ago, where they were spying on Ground Zero, on the Raging Grannies, on Not in My Name, and several other area groups, and most of those groups are among the litigants here, along with some others as well. And this is something that the ACLU is actually doing all over the country. They've filed these FOIAs in 20 different states so far, representing about 150 different peace groups. And, you know, give the ACLU credit. We've found out an awful lot about civil liberties violations by the Bush administration and, you know, spying on citizen activists who've done nothing illegal and so forth through this kind of court action by the ACLU. And they've really uncovered some truly valuable information that never would have seen the light of day otherwise.
All right. Well, jumping to national, the president has a team of very well-paid speechwriters, but there are times when you never know that.
Yeah. As was mentioned in Counterpunch, he had an amazing exchange with Helen Thomas at his press conference this week, in which Thomas asked why the war in Iraq had been started in the first place. And Bush, after asserting that, well, he didn't want war, which is palpably untrue, went on to talk about how 9/11 changed everything because we realized that murderers can kill innocent civilians. Well, you know, I think killers can kill innocent civilians, which is, you know, quite the revelation. And then he started talking about, well, the Taliban was providing safe haven for al-Qaeda, which, as far as I understand, was in Afghanistan. And then he started talking about, well, the entire world and the UN Security Council agreed on this because Saddam wouldn't let the inspectors in and he wouldn't give up his weapons of mass destruction. Well, there's several whoppers in that one. The Saddam did let the inspectors in, and they were scouring the country until they had to flee because of an imminent U.S. attack. The U.N. Security Council did not go along with that attack, and Saddam couldn't have given up any weapons of mass destruction because he hadn't had any since 1992. Not only that we learned this week that the U.S. immediately after overrunning Baghdad in 2003 found tapes of Saddam and his advisors meeting that made it clear that they destroyed all of their WDMDs in 1992. And they sat on that information, and they continued to claim for months afterwards that we're still looking for the WMDs, and they found them. And of course, he had his famous statement this week as well that we're going to have three more years of war, and then some other president is going to have to clean up the mess, which is you know, just a stunning abdication of responsibility, as well as, you know, a refusal to face reality, really. Another interesting thing about Bush this week is that came out that earlier this month, when he signed the reauthorization for the Patriot Act, he issued another one of his famous signing statements. And in that signing statement, he one of the provisions of the new Patriot Act was that Congress has to be told how the FBI is using its expanded powers. And Bush said, no, we don't have to tell Congress anything. I mean, the law requires it, but I'm not going to do it. So we have yet another example of the president saying, I'm above the law. Congress can pass any law they want, but I'm going to ignore it. We also had the Justice Department this week saying that they considered illegal NSA wiretaps to be admissible evidence in court, even when it involves lawyers and clients conversing with lawyer-client privilege or doctors and patients, similarly with medical privilege. And that, of course, raises the question of how often it's going to be likely that lawyers and clients are going to be making international calls to one another or doctors and patients. We're talking about domestic surveillance of American citizens within the United States. And the Justice Department just inadvertently admitted that, and nobody caught it.
All right. As well, sticking with our lawmakers, lobby reform looks like it's not going anywhere.
No, there was a Washington Post article this week that basically surveyed lobbyists themselves, and they were saying that, you know, with the very minor reforms that Congress is now considering, both the Republicans and the Democrats proposed very watered-down reforms, that the lobbyists said, it's just going to move the money around. We're going to do the same kind of thing with members of Congress that we've always done. So that's what happened to cleaning up the culture of corruption on Capitol Hill. It's just going to go on unabated. The Washington Post also had another interesting story this week talking about contracts for cleanup after Katrina that they have markups of as much as 1,700%. That's taxpayer money, of course, and a lot of those contracts are going to well-connected Republican-friendly companies.
Yeah, a lot of companies that are also doing work in Iraq, oddly
yes.
enough. All right. California has an interesting case dealing with Diebold.
Yes. Some activists in California are suing the state elections official who last year issued a certification that it was okay to use Diebold machines in California state elections. They're claiming, of course, I think probably accurately, that Diebold machines have been proven to be neither accurate nor secure and that the certification should be revoked. I think it's an interesting strategy and one that should be tried in Washington State and in any state where these machines are being used, because, you know, clearly it has been proven that these are unreliable machines and machines that can be rigged, and they're being built by a corporation that has talked openly about wanting to elect Republicans. So, you know, it's one thing to say that these machines shouldn't be used because they don't inspire voter confidence, but beyond that, it's been proven that they shouldn't be used because they don't meet the standards of these different states. So take it to court.
Actually, the electronic machines in Washington State are out officially.
Oh, are they? I had no idea.
Yeah, because both Snohomish County and then there was one other county that had them removed because they're going to mail-in ballots. So.
Oh, right, of course.
So, yeah, indirectly they are out. All right, and finally on national, the Zacharias Massawi trial.
Yes, an interesting revelation in that this week. A witness that was called both by the prosecution and the defense was a Minneapolis FBI agent who questioned Massawi, a guy named Harry Samet, and he apparently got wind from Massawi that there was something up about Al-Qaeda trying to crash planes into buildings, and he tried for 4 weeks, through August and September of 2001 to warn his superiors in the FBI, in the intelligence community, and in the White House that this plot was afoot and to try and nip it in the bud, and he got nowhere. He was ignored. And this once again underscores that not only the FBI and CIA, who were granted much more money and massive new powers after this spectacular display of incompetence, but also the Bush administration itself has never been held accountable for letting 9/11 happen. The greatest security failure in many, many generations in the United States, and for some reason people aren't blaming Bush for it, and they should.
Moving on to international, a lot been happening in Iraq this week, as does every week.
Yeah, although this was the third anniversary last Sunday, and so aside from the fact that there were worldwide protests, that were there were also people trying to take advantage of the attention that was being focused on Iraq. One of them, the offensive that we talked about on the air last week called Operation Swarmer, being carried out north of Samarra, well, it turned out to be a hoax. It turned out basically to be a publicity stunt. Yeah, U.S. and Iraqi troops were airlifted to the area. They found virtually nothing there. They exchanged no gunfire. There were no bombs dropped. It basically didn't happen. And this is what was being billed to the media as the largest U.S. and Iraqi military offensive since the beginning of the occupation. It was done for purely PR purposes at a time when a lot of tension was being focused on Iraq.
All right.
Beyond that, you know, as we had Bush saying, you know, three more years of war, we had a report in Time magazine that's since been corroborated in other places, that on November 19th of last year, there was a massacre of 15 civilians in a town called Hiditna in Iraq, where a U.S. statement at the time claimed that 10 people died in a roadside bomb explosion, mostly women and children. Well, it turned out that it was 15. They were found in their own homes, in their nightclothes, with you know, many, many bullet wounds, and blood spattered around the place. It was clear that they were shot there. It was clear that, you know, it was the middle of the night. They certainly weren't outside. And video was taken by a local journalist in the aftermath of this, and it's taken 4 months for it to surface. You know, it's a question of why it's taken 4 months to surface, but also the U.S. military clearly lied about what happened at the time. And, you know, Time has been kind of chicken on this, too, saying that it's not conclusive that it was a massacre of civilians by the U.S. Marine Corps, but it's almost unimaginable that you could draw any other conclusion. Let's see. We had an interesting development in the House of Representatives, where a House approved in a Barbara Lee amendment a ban on permanent bases in the funding bill, bases in Iraq. But at the same time, the funding bill had $348 million for base construction. And apparently, because the issue of permanent bases in Iraq is so politically sensitive, what the Bush administration is hoping to do is to turn the bases that they're building, and they are building huge bases in Iraq, over to the Iraqi government, with the understanding that the Iraqi government will then lease them back to the Americans. And this is why this is how they're going to try and get through the loophole. You know, they're still figuring that they're going to have a permanent U.S. military presence in Iraq, which ties in with the, you know, at least three more years of war. And finally, a British SAS unit rescued the three remaining Christian peace team hostages this week in Baghdad. Of course, Tom Fox, we mentioned a couple weeks ago, was tortured and murdered, the American hostage. But Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh and British CPT member Norbin Kimber were released unharmed. They still haven't found the kidnappers, but it's good to know that they're safe and sound.
All right. Talking, as we do every week, with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and to people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State is a local volunteer political newsletter. We have reporting, we have opinion, we have comics and humor, have an April Fool's issue coming up this coming week, and we never know what you might find. It's a free publication that you can find at bookstores and cafes and the King County Library System and other places where it's distributed. You can also find us on the web, www.eatthestate.org, including all of our back issues and our blog, where we weigh in on issues as they happen rather than every 2 weeks. And then last but not least, we do take comments and volunteers. We always welcome donations as well, but we're always happy to hear from folks. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.